Tapes for this, for all of the presentations at the three-day conference will be made available. I have been given an address from Harold Heckendorn to which you can write, but I don't see too much point in giving it out at this time because it'll take months for the material to be available, and I think it might be preferable to have the bulletin announce the address in Ottawa. But I can say that the cost for the tapes will be about $5 or $6 U.S. And it'll take a while, as I said, for them to become available. Secondly, I would remind you that if you have not registered for the banquet and you wish to attend, there is still some room available, and you should check with the front desk. And finally, someone yesterday left a nice folding umbrella, I'm told. So if you're missing it, it's out there. I haven't been given any indications that lights are left on license plate X9204. Again, I'd welcome to the stage Tom Owen, who is Director of Communications at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive and is so responsible for the smooth operation of this three-day event. I don't think it's really necessary to lay on all the plaudits that I did yesterday again, so I'll just say Tom Owen will speak to us on forensic audio.
Speech. Did somebody use our plug for the lamp here? I know. This is too technical for me.
Smoothly things were running until we talked about how things...
Michael, it only happens on my talk, right? Oh, well, that's all right.
I think it's what's causing the lightning.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me see something.
Slips in somehow.
It pushes in, I think.
Yeah, they can't figure it out. Why don't you try it?
Huh?
Yeah, figure out the contacts are made.
Well, I'm not going to stick my finger in the socket to see if it's hot. So. That's all right. The title of the speech is called Forensic Audio. Basically, what forensic audio is a relatively new science. It's a science of voice identification, and in my uses and other people's uses, looking at the way singers sing, the way people talk, the way instruments are played. And I just found out about 20 minutes ago that George Brachnanstadt also has a machine in his basement, and he's been doing a similar thing, which I didn't know, and maybe some of you didn't know. But anyway, we go back to 1867 when Melville Bell, Alexander Graham Bell's father, who was an authority in philology and phonetics, developed a phonetic alphabet which he called visual speech. Through these handwritten symbols, he succeeded in conveying to the eye information concerning the fine detail of speech sounds. The system brought Mr. Bell wide recognition, and it was used by him and later by his son, Alexander Graham Bell, in teaching the deaf to speak correctly. Alexander Graham Bell was not satisfied with just the handwritten symbols. He wanted to produce visual speech by direct action of the voice. In the midst of his search for such a scheme, he discovered the principles of telephony, and did quite well, by the way. He succeeded in... Anybody check the stock link? He succeeded eminently in the translation of speech to electrical currents and back to speech, but he did not find a way to translate the electrical currents to visual patterns. Numerous ways for making visual records of speech sounds have been devised in the past, but these records have not proved to be readable. Both the oscilloscope trace and the soundtracks on motion picture films are unreadable to the eye, although it is possible to obtain the original sound by means of a suitable recording device, reproducing device. Let me turn this on. This is a voice identification. This is a later model than the original one, but I didn't have a picture of the original one. A spectrograph development project was started at the Bell Laboratories in 1941. This device analyzed samples of speech in a visual record portraying frequency, intensity, and time relationships. Because of American participation in World War II, major interest was centered upon military requirements regarding spectrograph applications. During this period, acoustic scientists suggested that enemy radio voices might be able to be identified by spectrogram in order to detect the movement of units from place to place. Less was known then about voices, and because present techniques were not then available, this type of identification then proposed was very tedious and ineffective. I might mention that that weighs about 200 pounds, so they couldn't chase around radio operators from the German units very easily. Speech scientists have long been aware of wide variations in voices. This wide variation is one of the factors that has thwarted many efforts to build a machine that will understand a large variety of spoken words when uttered by different voices. The problem of recognition of speech by machine is a very formidable one. Primitive automatic recognizers have long been built that can identify a small vocabulary of words, digits 1 through 9 or code words. If reliability improves, it would be possible to dial your telephone by speaking the desired number. Well, we do that with the little tone beepers that we have now. Another possibility is a voice-operated typewriter, which has been in under development for at least 20 years and is still not a real thing yet. These areas of study have pointed up the truly remarkable uniqueness of the individual human voice. Several years ago, a law enforcement group inquired about what help they could get in combating telephone bomb scares to airlines and public buildings. Their particular interest was in being able to identify the voice of the perpetrator of such crimes. The problem was referred to the Acoustic and Speech Research Department of Bell Laboratories. The foundation of voice print identification is based on the premise that every individual's voice is a uniquely characteristic enough to distinguish it from all others by voice print analysis. The theory of the premise lies in the fundamental processes of human speech. There are two general factors involved. The first factor is in determining voice uniqueness, and it lies in the sizes of the vocal cavities. The four major cavities affecting speech are throat, nasal, and two oral cavities formed by the mouth and the position of the tongue. The vocal cavities are resonators, much like organ pipes, reinforcing some of the overtones produced by the vocal cords and producing formants or voice print bars. These cavities have the property of selective transmission and radiation dependent upon sizes and manner in which they are coupled. What that means is
Excuse me a second, let me turn this around.
Only on my speech, right? Okay. Okay. The articulators that we refer to are the mouth, the tongue, the teeth, the way your jaw is, whether it's forward, whether it's back, how big your lips are. These are very, very important phonetically. And this is just a picture of a medical picture like we have all seen before. Other things that are involved are the vocal cords, where the air comes up. We talked about when Robert Merrill and Anna Moffo were talking the other day about singing, how when they did pop songs, they just sang from the head, and instead of singing like that. So it's very important that we know in voice identification a little bit about, you don't have to be an expert or a doctor in it, but you have to know a little bit about the articulators, about breathing, and that sort of thing, to be able to read what we call voice prints. This is what was primarily called a primary indication of a voice print, and in what we know as a linear expanded mode. When you say a word, or you sing something, or you shoot a gun and it makes an acoustic noise, or you slam the door, it all has a certain acoustical print that can be spectrographically printed. When you do print these things, this is what they end up looking like. This is speech. Somebody is saying, this is a voice print, and they're saying it like that. They're not saying, this is a voice print. They're saying, this is a voice print. Just to make it very easy for us to see, we can read vowels and we can read consonants in this manner. A little later, I'm going to play a tape of some singing, and you're going to see what are known as the formats. As we said before, the vocal cavity, the lips, and so forth are resonators. They produce formats, and these formats appear in this manner. Thus far, we have discussed a person's normal speech. A second basic premise of voice print identification is that any intelligible speech is satisfactory for voice print identification purposes, providing there are voice sounds or phonemes common to both known and unknown samples to be compared. There is limited empirical evidence to indicate that various conditions of disguised speech intended to confound a trained observer only made identification more difficult but not impossible. We see that in the type of cases that criminal cases and identification cases that I'm involved in, where people will go out and you can buy from various dealers around the country little black boxes to speak through on your telephone. Many of them are nothing more than pitch transposers, the kind that you used if you or any of you are musicians and you've you can't afford to get another guy for the gig, so you go out and buy an Ibanez chorus or flanger or something like that. People use these things all the time, and when they're making phone calls to the police departments, what they don't realize is that if they drop their voice down a couple of octaves with one of these things and they sound like a frog, all you have to do is buy a similar gadget and raise it back up, and then you get a voice print as the way it should look. Now, it must be expected that a file of voice prints would accumulate to a point where it would not be feasible to examine every file card against a sample, an unknown sample. A manual classification, such as used in fingerprinting to permit a more efficient search, is the logical answer. Speech is dynamic, and the same sound produced by the same speaker on two different occasions is never quite identical. Further, portions of the voice print pattern may be altered by the context in which the cue word is used. Like I mentioned before, you can say, there's a bomb in the building, or you can say, there's a bomb in the building, or you can say, there's a bomb in the building. And the way you say something, or the way you sing something, each has a different imprint. Now, because when they made this technology, when they developed it at Bell Labs for the war ended before it really got to a point where it was something that could be thrown out into the scientific community and evaluated seriously. What happened was, at the end of it, Mr. Lawrence Kersta, a physicist, was involved because the police departments of New York City and elsewhere had appealed to Bell Labs to take this up again. So there was a second book. I mentioned Mr. Bell's book, the early book in 1857 called Visible Speech. There was a second book called Visible Speech by the three of the guys who originally worked on this at Bell Labs from 41 to about 46 or 7. And that was Potter, Knopp, and Green, and this book is still available, I believe. So Bell Labs, at the request of law enforcement, resumed experimentation on speaker identification and assigned Mr. Lawrence Kirsta the task of developing a reliable methodology for speaker ID. Over a period of 2 years, Mr. Kirsta tested 123 participants. He trained 9 high school girls to perform the identification in a controlled environment. The findings were as follows. Over 50,000 identification attempts were made from over 16,000 spectrograms, and Mr. Kirster reported the results yielded a correct identification score of 99.65%. In the 60s, Mr. Kirster left Bell Labs to start Voiceprint Laboratories of Somerville, New Jersey, and started to train voiceprint examiners. The Michigan State Police and a representative from Michigan State University, which has a tremendous speech archive, Dr. Oscar Tosi, trained at the New Jersey Laboratory in 1967. From 1967 to 1970, Dr. Tosi conducted an extensive study into speaker identification by spectrography and concluded that given good voice samples and sufficient time for processing and by following certain procedures, the margin of error was negligible. The first test of admissibility, meaning when it was allowed into a courtroom, was affirmed by the Minnesota Supreme Court November 26, 1971, in the Constant Trimble case, which was a case where a lady called the police department on the 911 number, which is in most larger police departments automatically recorded, and said that she was having a baby and wanted the police to come and take her to the hospital. When the police got there, somebody shot one of them from across the street. Now, her attorney objected on the premise that this evidence had never been allowed in any court and had never been tested, nor the scientific evaluation done. But it was proven by Dr. Tosi and Ernie Nash from the Michigan State Police and others that this is a viable method. They got in what is known as an exemplar from Constance Trimble. She had to say the same thing she said on the telephone call in the same manner, and they were able to match those prints. And she was later convicted and owned up to making the telephone call at her trial. Now we're going to have a little fun with this. I went around the archive and I asked if I wanted to present singing voice prints of a singer, who would be ideal from a lot of different standpoints, and the name Maria Callas came into mind. So we're going to play 3 excerpts of Maria Callas from 1950, from 1953, and from 1965. And let me get the note right, at least I'd be. It's a high B flat from Vizi D'Arte from Puccini's Tosca, Act 2. Maria Callas, Mexico City, 1950, Maria Callas, Milan, 1953, and Maria Callas, Paris, 1965. I can just remember how this thing worked. There you go. Listen for the high note. Those are not restorations. They were taken right off opera, some unique opera or something. This is 1950, all right? You're looking for several things. Well, the purpose of this, you can print these prints certain ways. You see 3 lines. The lower is the first format, the second is the second format, and the third upper line is the third format. Concern yourself mainly with the upper line. The difference between these two points was from here to here. You can't see it on this, but there are timing marks on here, and we're thinking about vibrato and so forth. This was the thrust of this using Maria Callas. It seems that there's some question as to her vibrato over a span of years. I'm not going to make any judgments about her singing, you know. I'll let you do that, all right? We're concerned about how when she's coming up, this is where she's coming in on the note here. All right, and she's coming along the line here, and these areas from here to here, or from here to here, are a little uneven. And these are these vertical, what we call vertical striations, are the resonances of her throat. All right? So this is early 1950. You also want to be concerned about how far over the line she goes and how far below the line she goes. Remember, we're just primarily concerned with the top print there and the top print there. That's the start of the note. This is the finish of the note. As she finishes the note, is she as high, for lack of a better term, as she is on the beginning of the note? Now we'll look at 1953. Well, wait, let's ask questions in a second here. Now, unfortunately, I can't squeeze all of these into one transparency, so you have to sort of remember what the last one looked like. It's a little difficult. But so here, she's actually, these messy prints look messy because there's a lot of band in there, and that's what we call noise. So she's doing a little better here, okay? But down here, this is where she does her, what's it called? Da-da-da, you know how she did that, her little Maria Callas bit, right here. No judgments. I'm not making any judgments.
Embellishment.
Embellishment. That's a good word. Okay. So the primary concern is the top line here. All right. The distances between the black parts on the. On the transparency. Here she. This is the last one in 65. Now she's coming up on the note here, and she's fairly even in terms of what we refer to as pitch along here. Here she starts wobbling a little bit. And extending, okay? So her vocal cavity is making some adjustments to get the note out. Okay, now I'm going to play, continue playing the tape of another singer. I'll let you guess who it is. Anybody? That's right. As one critic said, the real Renata. Now, concern yourself with the third line, this line right here that goes across here. Much shorter than our friend Miss Callas. A completely different type of vocal cavity resonance, all right? And in terms of pitch and so forth, it's very, very good. Here, again, but a definitely much different
vocal track configuration for that particular note. That's from Tibaldi in New York in 1956. The next note is a high B from Hoya to Ho. I don't think I have to tell you who the singer is. Yes. Again, pay attention to the distances between the high points here and the low points here, as well as the second line on this line here. She's pretty much on the money, as they say. Her voicings are very full. She gets much less of a second format than does Maria Callas or Tibaldi. That has something to do with the note that the way she's producing the tone and the kind of singing that she's doing. Singing in general is very difficult to print. I got into this because of the Mapleson cylinders. We were trying to identify a particular cylinder. And at that point, it was really up in the air. Could have been Melba, could have been Calvé, could have been Suzanne Adams. So I called around some of my engineer friends, and they says, well, why don't you voice print it? And I didn't know what voice print really was. So I went to the New York City police, and they know a lot about voice prints. I think 9,000 calls a day, something like that. But the gentleman there, Gene McDonald, who was the sergeant in charge of the lab, he set it up. He was an audio nut, and he was very, very helpful, and he got me into this in a what eventually became a very big way. We tried to print that particular Faust trio cylinder, but we were not successful because the noise on that cylinder is just too great to make even a probable identification or elimination. So that wasn't successful on that particular cylinder. You have to use certain criteria when making these judgments. But it eventually led to me using this on other things, including criminal work, as well as the interesting to see how Foreman does a note, or somebody like tapes that I would be working with at the time. And that's basically what I had to say about it. I don't want to go into great technical detail about how the machine works. It really doesn't matter for this group, I don't think.
Tom, I'm curious as to the frequency range, the dynamic range, and the length of the action. Because I tried this at the University of Colorado in 1975 and got nicks out of it.
Well,
I suspect it was because of the limitations of the machine that was available.
The length of the print is 2.5 seconds. The dynamic range is variable. The frequency is at best 8 kilohertz. Okay. There's a lot of questions. Okay, Barney.
Record.
Right.
You've got
the
room acoustics of a present.
The what?
Room acoustics.
Right.
Spectrum. And you also have
Well, that's why a very high, very pronounced note was chosen for this.
Yeah.
Normally, you don't do singing for positive voice identification. I've had cases where that has been the case. People would sing a message into the telephone, a threatening message, and but they would. Yeah. And it wasn't from the Metropolitan Opera either. Yeah. You know. But you can. It doesn't have to be an anechoic chamber to make a positive ID or a positive elimination. Right, but the kind of work this is used for, I don't think we're going to get those kind of people into a sound booth to make those phone. Yes?
Can I comment on the forensic or police aspects of so-called voice prints? Because there are in police science circles, of which I was a member for a while, this is a hot topic. The work of